It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and Let's Talk Legal.
And Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, in the studio with us now, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
All right, what are we talking about today?
Ben, let's talk about the word fiduciary and who best might be our fiduciary and what in the world such a word as that means.
Yes, right. Let's start there.
It's mighty early in the morning to be talking about a word like fiducciary.
Yeah, we like mono and duo syllable words
we
at this hour.
A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Fiduciary, Ben, is your person in your documents that you are appointing as your agent. To serve in the capacity of settling your affairs. I mean, this is, in fact, the person that is your agent in your power of attorney, your executor in your will, the trustee of your trust, all of those people, trustee, attorney, in fact, in your durable power of attorney, executor, are subcategories of the word fiduciary. Those all serve in a capacity as an agent for you. There is a high standard of care for a fiduciary. Let's keep in mind that these people are not handling their own assets. They are handling the assets of another, and therefore they are held to a high standard of what, you know, a reasonable person would do when they are making decisions on behalf of another. You know, we're able, or maybe some folks are able, to throw their own resources around, so to speak.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Do what you doggone well please. I mean, every now and then I have clients who say that to
I
me.
Would imagine
they
that.
They say, well, you know, it is my resource. I'm going to do with it what I please.
Mm-hmm.
And they absolutely are allowed to do with their resources as they please. But when you are a fiduciary, you are not allowed to make speculative investments. You are not allowed to let assets lay idle. You are not allowed to do any kind of self-dealing or anything that could be considered to be not in the best interest of the person whose resources you happen to be handling.
And we've had that question lately, too.
We have, absolutely.
Listener.
Absolutely. One of the most if not the most active area of the law, and this is not just in Carteret County, but really statewide and nationwide, is fiduciary liability. It is a very large, growing, and very active practice for most law firms, fiduciary liability.
And you mentioned the ones where it comes into a personal realm, for example, an executive estate, somebody holds a durable power of attorney and trust, and it comes up, some people may realize, but not realize that it comes up. Church trustees have fiduciary responsibilities.
They
do. On a board of directors, you have a fiduciary responsibility. So it happens in people's lives. It's pretty frequent.
Now, Ben, the first question that Wes and I always get is, well, you know, I have a son, and he lives in Oregon, but I have a daughter that lives in Newport, but I really would prefer to appoint my son, but I know that I can't appoint my son because he lives in Oregon, and I need to appoint my daughter who lives in Newport. And, of course, this is a common misunderstanding.
Very
common. And so what we want to say this morning is we want you to appoint the person that you think will handle your affairs the most competently and the most reasonably. It does not matter where they live. We would rather have a competent and reasonable person in Oregon than a not competent and not responsive fiduciary right around the corner. So it does not matter where your fiduciary happens to live.
And just over your time practicing law, that has changed in terms of the ease. Because
well,
of
it has, because of, you know, just technology, of course, email, you know, overnighting, facsimile, all of these things have eased those kinds of efforts. Now, it is true that if you are the executor of an estate and you are out of state, okay, then you are going to need to appoint a resident agent, which is really only someone in the state of North Carolina, Ben, that can receive service of process, you know, that can receive legal notice to the estate since you happen to live in Oregon.
Okay.
We're not going to require the sheriff of our state to travel to Oregon
right.
to serve that executor with legal process. So in the estate, early on during the qualification period, there is an appointment of a registered agent, and then the sheriff is allowed to serve any kind of legal process, legal papers that I'm referring to, on that person who lives within the state.
Okay, so maybe this is too technical a question, but can that be a post office box? I mean, can they have a post office box, or they have to have a residence or a place where they can be found?
Well, normally it's going to be an attorney that represents the estate, but it could certainly be, you know, someone else who is a resident of North Carolina, and typically you want an actual, you know, mailing address where you can actually, you know, mail documents to.
Or drive to.
Right, that's right. And, you know, even when we're talking about service, I mean, even if you did have a post office box, I don't think technically in the rule and under the rules of civil procedure, you know, that is prohibited. But then when you get into the rules of civil procedure under Rule 4 and Rule 5, which are the rules dealing with service, then, you know, sheriff service is going to be personal service delivered, like hand delivered, to whoever that resident process agent is. So again, I think the question about the post office box, again, I don't think that there's an issue with that or is prohibited in the statute, but the service is really more like on the person as opposed to the address.
But like you said, it's often an attorney, a local attorney.
Yeah, usually an attorney. That's right, the attorney representing the respective estate.
Right.
So whatever notice is required, we don't have to go track down this, you know, fiduciary who's in Oregon or in wherever. Doesn't matter what the issue is. If there's some issue pertaining to the estate, when you have to give, you know, service of process, like a petition to revoke letters testamentary in the event that you think that the fiduciary is breaching their duty.
Sure.
Self-serving, self-dealing, these type things, and you're wanting to have the clerk of court consider whether they're to be removed, you don't have to go get them served in wherever state they live. The statute simplify that to allow us to effect service here locally with whoever that resident process agent is. And in the event that there's a failure to properly appoint a resident process agent, that in and of itself is grounds for revocation of letters. So that's a pretty serious issue there in statute 28A, which is a state's, decedent's estate's statute.
Now, Ben, some other things to talk about this morning are that it is important that you coordinate between your documentation who your designated fiduciary or agent needs to be. We're very tuned into this at our office because it's important that, you know, you don't want, you know, daughter Sue to be the power of attorney, to be your agent under the power of attorney.
Right.
Okay. Known as your attorney in fact, by the way. How is that for being confusing?
Yes.
Has nothing to do with the fact that Sue is or is not an attorney. It just so happens that under a power of attorney, we lawyers had to make it a bit more confusing and call that person an attorney in fact. Okay. But they are not necessarily a licensed attorney.
They're not the attorney at law.
No, they are not an attorney at law many times. They can be, but many times they are not. Okay, but you don't want to have one daughter as your attorney in fact under a power of attorney and then have yet a different daughter your executor under the will. That really doesn't quite add up. Let's keep in mind that your power of attorney is going to be the person that will help with payment of bills and insurance claims, medical bills, things of that nature. If there's nursing home expenses, last expenses of the home, they will be in the loop relative to that information. Right,
as far as the information
goes. As far as that information. And then, of course, when we are no longer living, it makes perfect sense for that very same person then to then become the executor because they have the information.
Because the power of attorney ends at death.
It does. Right. It ends at death, and the executorship takes over. And so to coordinate those two persons is important. We are always just shocked to see documents come into our office where X person is the power of attorney, and yet another person is the executor of the estate. That is usually not where we would hope to land in a file. Okay? I might also add that, and this is technical, but an executor has the duty of winding down the affairs of the decedent, and that includes making inquiry and investigation if necessary as to those matters that occurred while the decedent was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So an executor has a duty to look back during the life of the decedent, the last year or so, and say, well, were things handled properly?
Right.
For instance, maybe this person has a claim against someone, a caregiver, someone in the family, if you will, whatever the case might be, that took advantage of them in some way.
A questionable gift.
A questionable gift.
Right.
Any number of issues. Okay, so the person who is the power of attorney is going to know about those things, okay, and therefore will not have to do a diligent inquiry, such as a new executor would have to do.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, again, we're going to take a break and come back, but if you have questions on this, you can give us a call at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. As we continue on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, online at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 at AM 1240. And Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us. If you would like to call, 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674.
Ben, I'd like to address this morning, and we're going to have to continue on next week about this subject matter, but I would say 60-65% of the time clients come in and they absolutely know who they want their executor to be. But there's a strong percentage of folks who want to talk about that with their lawyer. They maybe want to appoint two children as co, or they don't have children, let's say.
Right.
Or they don't perceive that they have a child that would be up to the task. Okay, now this creates some time and energy for us as lawyers to talk this through with the client, and I want to hasten to say that at our law firm, as well as I think most good law firms, the lawyer does not interject that, well, we can be the fiduciary. Let us be the executor. In our office, for instance, Ben, we really do not encourage clients at all to appoint Wes or myself or any other lawyer in our law office as the executor.
Right.
There needs to be overriding factors that would leave that as a last resort. I mean, I'm hearing all the politics right now, and yesterday's discussion was about war, you know, philosophy of war, and the politicians were saying, well, it's a last resort, okay? Well, I believe that that's the case with appointing your lawyer as your fiduciary. It is your last resort, okay? Let's attempt to find someone in your family that will handle this matter. And then let Wes and myself serve as the attorney to guide this member of your family, okay, to give them advice, to be along their side. They don't have to be, you know, the perfect fiduciary, you know, highly educated or anything of that nature.
Right.
Let's let them be the executor, and we will guide them along the process, mm-hmm. okay? It really happens to be those extreme files, the great exception to the rule, mm-hmm. where the client either does not have any children whatsoever, nor do they happen to have a strong niece or nephew relationship,
mm-hmm.
okay? Or they have children that they just can't rely on. The child has a drug addiction problem, something of that nature,
right.
okay?
Sure.
These are the kinds of facts that we see when finally we need to then serve as the fiduciary for that client. But that is not something that is a first response,
mm-hmm.
okay? That is a down the road after we have exhausted all other possibilities. We would much prefer to serve at the pleasure of the fiduciary and give them good, sound legal advice along the way,
mm-hmm.
rather than necessarily wearing the hat. Now, with all that said, Ben,
mm-hmm.
we absolutely have files
yes.
where we are the fiduciary.
Right.
We are, in fact, the attorney. In fact, under the power of attorney,
mm-hmm.
we are the executor under the will. We have to keep in mind that we are a profession here, Ben, and we mm-hmm. are lawyers, and we are held to a very high standard. And what I mean by that is just that there are certain times when we really do have to step up to the plate
mm-hmm.
and serve for our clients in these capacities.
All right, we have a caller standing by. Let's talk to Todd in Pollocksville. Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm fine this morning. How are you?
Doing fine. And what's your question for us today?
Well, first of all, I thoroughly enjoy the programs that you have in the mornings. I really do.
Well, thank you.
Stay with me. This is my first time calling in, but
okay.
I do have a dilemma. I have a family member who is almost 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the power of attorney, durable power of attorney, medical power of attorney, and he has also named me as executor in his will.
Good.
But now he has suggested that I put my name on the checking account with him, which I have power of attorney over anyway, and I'm just wondering what the pitfalls might be to that.
Well, thank you, Todd.
For
your compliment there, and thank you for calling in this morning.
Todd, sure.
you really nailed it. I can tell just from the nature in the way in which you framed your question, you know, how you have it very organized and you're understanding things. You have his power of attorney. There is no real need to change the title to his bank account to add you as a joint owner. This is a very common question. It is a common factual scenario that
right.
we see, Ben, as we've
yes.
discussed on the programs many times, that clients say, well, I added my son or my daughter or my nephew to my stock account because I wanted her to have access to my account. Well, the account happens to be $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the banker just happens to make it joint.
Right.
With this person,
right?
Okay, which then or POD or TOD or joint with right of survivorship, all of those designations, all of which are a program here at the
mm-hmm.
talk station
sure.
in and of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've talked about
right.
that,
right?
And now this account becomes the ownership of this account upon death is vested in the fiduciary.
Yes, instead of the estate.
Instead of the estate. And, of course, many times that is different than necessarily, say, the terminology in the will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the estate is going in certain percentages, and yet now this asset is titled in the name of the fiduciary. You run into tax consequences with this. You have legal liability consequences when you have people on the account. So the best procedure is exactly as Todd mentioned, which is that he is the power of attorney, register the power of attorney, and then register it with the financial institution and have access to the account, but do not put your agent's name on the account.
Okay, let's go back to that idea. What does it mean to register the account?
Register the power of attorney first means to have it recorded in the register of deeds, and
okay.
I'm sure that Todd's is, and then of course giving a copy of the recorded power of attorney to the banking institution.
Then you're done.
Right. They then register that account as a power of attorney account, mm-hmm. that Todd has access to this particular account through the recorded power of attorney. They of course make a copy of it, they send it to their legal department, and they make a note of that. Of course, that's on the mm-hmm. the registry now at the bank that Todd is the power of attorney. He is the agent over the account. That is very different legally than being an owner of the account.
Yes. Right. Todd, does that answer it for you?
It answers it very well, and I appreciate that. And also, one more question, follow-up. Does the power of attorney automatically end in the passing of the person?
Yes, sir. It does. It does end. The power of attorney is revoked as a matter of law upon our death.
Mm-hmm.
And at that very moment, the executor then takes over. And that is why we said earlier in the program that it makes perfect sense for the agent under the power of attorney and the executor to be the same person. Because as we're seeing inherent in Todd's question, mm-hmm. he is in the loop with his 100-year-old relative.
Okay, Todd, thank you for your question. We appreciate that. And as we come back, we'll finish it up here with Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, Attorneys at Law, online at harvellandcollins.com. Now, back to Todd's case, just real quickly here, I got thinking that the only difference is that it's a few more words you have to write on the check, right? I mean,
yeah, that's right. The recommendation in almost every case is going to be, you know, if you have a proper power of attorney put in place, it's recorded in the county in which it is mm-hmm. going to be used to do exactly what Cecil said, record it and then have it take it to the financial institution where the account is that you're interested in having access to, or the principal is interested in you having access to. They'll take a copy of that. They'll put you in the system.
And you're signing in as POA,
and then
you're
signing as POA. And that just is such, from a legal perspective, an attorney's perspective, that is a much more clean situation mm-hmm. where you're not subjecting that account to your personal liability. There aren't any tax consequences with regard to it. And most importantly, by putting someone on your account jointly, you may be unintentionally upsetting your estate plan.
That's right.
Because that is going to trump whatever your will may say about where that account goes.
Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, this person owns the account. And then even if they were responsible and they want to distribute it, then you have a gift tax issue.
That's right. So, however, I can kind of read the tea leaves here on this. In the event that, let's say, Todd goes to the financial institution
mm-hmm.
and sits down with the banker and says, this is what I want to do. In dealing with this for many years now, it's almost like there's a canned response sometimes at many financial institutions. And that response will be, well, why don't we just make the account joint?
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what we don't want to do.
Right.
See, the banks, the financial institutions are used to doing that, mm-hmm. but not as used to making the account a POA account.
Get your advice from Harvell & Collins by calling 252-726-9050.